All right, so this morning we want to talk some about God's judgment on the gods of Egypt. The one downside to this font is that it capitalizes gods in this instance, and I don't particularly like that because this is not the true God. So this is God's judgment on the gods of Egypt, or better known as the plagues of Egypt. And so you all get to be the guinea pigs on this one, and I hope that it all makes sense and that it all ties together. I've spent a lot of time with this. As Christy pointed out, I've made references to it over and over and over again, so she was ready to hear the whole thing. All right, I want us to start with Proverbs 29 and verse 1. Proverbs 29 and verse 1, here it is written, "He who is often rebuked and hardens his neck will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy." Who does that immediately make you think of in the context of the plagues of Egypt? And it fits so well, doesn't it? And I think that this is a very apt proverb for a jumping off point for this study. And so here, as we said, it is written, you know, he is often rebuked, hardens his neck. He makes it difficult. He won't listen. And he is suddenly destroyed, and that without remedy, cannot come back from that. And so we will get to that point today. And so as we progress through this lesson, we want to think about the plethora of gods that Egypt had, and then the final one that we'll talk about is Pharaoh himself and how God defeated all of them, and the purposes for doing that. And so throughout the Old Testament, it is clear that Israel struggled constantly with the sin of idolatry. And Wednesday nights we're talking about, we're discussing the book of Hosea, and that's obviously the big problem in that book, is Israel's problem with idolatry. And so from the very beginning of Israel as a nation, we see that God is proving himself over and over and over again to be the only deity, the only God. And so within the Ten Commandments, as we call them, Moses, or God through Moses, says, "You shall have no other gods before me," which was then followed up by, "You shall not make for yourselves a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." And so this comes not all that long after God brings Israel out of Egypt, and so they should theoretically be remembering what God had just done. All the proof and the evidence God had just given them as to his own power. Now, obviously, Israel did not get that, but we can learn from what God has done. Two questions that we should ask is, does this mean that Israel could have other gods just so long as God was in first place? And was that the intent of God when he says this? Now, obviously, that is not what God meant. And what we learn from the plagues of Egypt is that God completely and utterly destroyed faith in any other so-called god that the Egyptians had. And what should have happened with Israel is they should have looked at that and said, well, none of these gods could stand up against God, and so clearly they're not real. Clearly they could not stop God. And of course that is the overall purpose. And so we should learn what the Israelites did not learn, even though we are not personally seeing these things happen. And so think about the fallacies of idolatry. And I'm going to briefly reference some of the stuff we've been studying in Hosea, so we don't have to go into absolutely all of this. But think about Jeremiah 10. Jeremiah 10, beginning in verse 2, it is written, "Thus says the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, nor be dismayed at the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. For the customs of the peoples are vanity. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold, and they fashion it with a hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Their idols are like scarecrows in the cucumber field, and they cannot speak. They have to be carried because they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good." So you have these stationary objects that cannot do anything. Now, if we stop and we think about all those hieroglyphics that are on the walls of the pyramids that depict the gods, they're there 2,000 years later. They've not gotten down. They've not walked away. They can't do anything. They faded. They faded to the point that they have to be fixed by experts today. But think about the fallacies of this. Here you have something that has to be made by man. It has to be made by man. It has to be carried. It has to be fastened. And yet it cannot do anything of its own accord. And then we think about the true God. And that's the purpose of this today. And so we can't, you know, a idol requires man to build it. It requires that man build it secure. It cannot build itself. And think about many of the examples that we have. Dagon before the Ark of God. It falls down. It can't pick itself up. Dagon falls down again after they go in and they pick it up and they can't figure out, well, we've got to be the one to pick this up. It can't pick itself up. The second time it falls down and it breaks and it cannot repair itself. And so what we see is that, and the reference to that is 1 Samuel 5, 1-5. And so we see that it has no actual power. But when we compare that with the true God, what we find is that God can amazingly show that he is true, that he is all-powerful. And of course, you can reference things like 1 Kings 18 and 1 Samuel 5, 1-5 once again. And so there is a clear distinction between God and idols. Power versus absolutely nothing. Think about God's decision to execute judgment on the Egyptian gods. And so we have God saying that he's going to do this. This happens in Exodus 12 and verse 12. It says, "And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment." Now that's late, isn't it? I mean, the plagues have already started by this point, right? This declaration comes at kind of the culmination of the plagues. And so we have to think about that and what God is doing and what God has been doing all along. And so while all the plagues were horrible in their own right, I mean, I don't think anybody looks at the plagues of Egypt and goes, man, I'd really like to have lived through that. That just sounds like a wonderful time. When we get to the death of the firstborn, this is kind of the one of the worst things that can possibly happen in Egypt. It's not that other things weren't bad. They were, but this is kind of the icing on the cake, or the worst one, as you might say. And so let's jump into this. First of all, I want us to think about the magicians. As I was reading through Exodus, and I read through this account multiple times in preparation of this, I kept going back to these magicians and wondering, what was their purpose? Why are we even told about them? Why did God allow them to interrupt what was going on? And it's actually that they didn't interrupt. God used them. God used them, and Pharaoh didn't get that God was using them. And so I want us to think about that this morning. So the magicians played a significant role in what happened in Exodus, but why and how? First, note the reasons that God chose to send the plague. So turn over to Exodus chapter 7. Exodus 7, beginning in verse 3, and reading down through verse 5, it says, "But I will harden," this is God speaking, of course, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you." Do you ever think about it from Moses' perspective? All right, Moses, go do this job, even though ultimately with Pharaoh you're going to fail. God tells him that right up front. And yet Pharaoh, of course, Moses goes and does it. "Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my host, the people of the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring my people of Israel from among them." So this was a learning experience for the people of Egypt, and it was supposed to be a learning experience for the people of Israel as well. So think about that and keep that in mind. And so think about what the magicians do. You ever think about, as you read through this, the fact that they duplicated? Now, I mean, we could debate whether or not they actually did it or whether they used illusions or whatever, but, you know, the Bible says that they duplicated it. They did it. So whatever it was, whether it was real, perhaps by the powers of the devil, I don't know. Whatever it was enough to convince Pharaoh that they were duplicating what Moses did. And so the rods to serpents. Exodus 7, beginning in verse 11, says, "Then Pharaoh summoned the wise men and sorcerers, and they, the magicians of Egypt, also did the same by their secret arts." Whatever that may be, by their secret arts, they did it. "For each man cast down his staff, and they became serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs." Still, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. And so, this is the first one that they duplicate. And to me, I find it really intriguing that they're able to duplicate it, and yet God says, okay, but Aaron's staff's still going to eat yours. And so this is still an exertion of God's power over them. So even though they're duplicating it, and this works into Pharaoh hardening his heart. And that's why I say God is using the magicians to his advantage to do what he said at the very beginning he was going to do. The second one, water to blood, Exodus 7, 22 and 23, "But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not take even this to heart." And so even as these plagues are starting to happen, even as these signs are starting to happen, they're duplicating these things, and it helps to further harden Pharaoh's heart. Remember, this is a judgment on Pharaoh as much as it is the gods of Egypt, and there's a reason for that. And then, of course, there is the frogs, Exodus 8 and verse 7, "But the magicians did the same by their secret arts and made frogs come up on the land of Egypt." So whatever they're doing, however they're doing it, God's allowing this to happen. Do you think God couldn't have stopped this? You know, even if they had their secret arts, if God did not want this to happen, could God not have stopped that? And so God is allowing this to happen by whatever methods, and it is helping to harden Pharaoh's heart. And so they play this really important role. But then we get to what they could not do. And so God allows them to do enough to harden Pharaoh's heart, and then God says, okay, now I'm going to show a distinction between my people, Moses and Aaron, and these magicians. The lice in Exodus 8, verses 18 and 19 says, "The magicians tried by their secret arts to produce gnats," in this translation, "but they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, 'This is the finger of God.' But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them as the Lord had said." So now we've gotten to the point where Pharaoh's heart's so hard that even his magicians are saying, this is something different. This is something we can't do. This is true power. And by this point, Pharaoh is saying, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to listen. And so they couldn't do that. And then we get to the boils. And so, through the first few things, they're able to do it. Then you get to the lice or the gnats, and they can't do it. And then you get to the boils. Exodus 9, beginning in verse 11, it says, "And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils. For the boils came upon the magicians and upon all the Egyptians, but the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had spoken to Moses." And to me, this is just like the watershed moment for the magicians. That here is, they are able to do it, then they can't do it, and now they're not even able to physically stand before Moses. They can't stand before him, let alone try to duplicate what Moses, or what the plagues have been happening to the Egyptians there. And so there's this progression from God through this section that just should have destroyed any faith they had in the magician. So here you have the man, you have these so-called powerful magicians that apparently had some skill, there's no doubt about that. And the people and Pharaoh, they placed great faith in them, And God used them to harden Pharaoh's heart, to accomplish his end goal. That's what God did. And since I just spoke about this last week, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this portion of the sermon this morning, but it seems like this is rather a Old Testament application of 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 to 12. And so keep that in mind, that strong delusion that is sent because they do not love the truth. It seems to be an Old Testament application of that. And so it is in this manner that God destroyed the faith that the Egyptians had in their magicians. Do you think the people of Egypt were looking on that and going, they can't do it now. There's something wrong here. We're finally figuring this out. And yet they still follow the Pharaoh, rather. All right, so the next thing, oh, look at that. That's amazingly unhelpful. Sorry, hang on 1 second. Believe it or not, I actually went through this PowerPoint like 3 times trying to make sure everything worked, and I still managed to have a glitch. All right, so I want us to think for a little bit about what some of the common views on the gods of Egypt are. And I'll close out with a point about whether or not it impacts our reading of it as far as our faith goes. But I went through a whole bunch of different stuff and looked at a whole bunch of ways that people look at the plagues and what God is doing, and so I want us to think about that this morning. One of the first views, and probably the most common views, is that there is one God per plague view. And so essentially what this is for each individual plague, it would be a direct attack on a single god in Egypt. And I don't think that that is necessarily a poor view to take. I've got some other reasons as to why I think some of the other views might be a little different or perhaps a little bit better. To me, I'm just presenting this as what makes the least sense to me, and hopefully that helps as you guys think through this yourself as well. That even though it is perhaps the most common, I don't think it makes the most sense. So within the Egyptian pantheon of gods, each element had multiple gods attached. So you would have, say, the sun. There were multiple gods attached to that idea or that element. You have the Nile. There were multiple gods that were attached to that. And we'll dig into that a little bit more in the next point. One of the authors I read said that over time the ancient Egyptian had as many as 2,000 deities. So narrowing it down to just a single god per plague would be rather difficult. And of course that would also mean we have to narrow it down to exactly the specific time frame and what the Egyptians were worshiping at that particular time. And that came and went and things changed. Which honestly speaks to the ancient Egyptian religion in and of itself. And so it's not to say that God could not or necessarily did not target specific Egyptian deities, but I think that there are some other options that might be a little bit more reasonable or make a little bit more sense. And so that, there you go. That's where that was supposed to come in. And so this is obviously not 2,000 of the gods. This is just a brief look at some of the gods that the Egyptians worshipped. And of course, these would be perhaps some of the more well-known ones. And so keep that in mind. And some of those will come back up in a couple of minutes too. And so the second view is multiple gods per plague view. And honestly, I have a tendency to go a little bit more towards this view even more than the third view that I'll show in a couple of minutes. And so with this view, essentially each plague attacked a subcategory of gods. So as I mentioned, you know, there would be multiple gods attached to the Nile somehow. And so when he attacks the Nile, he's actually attacking and defeating multiple gods that were attached to the Nile. And so to me, that makes a lot more sense. And I think it helps whenever we think about there is 2,000 plus gods, that God is saying, okay, I'm going to defeat all of them by doing this. And so hopefully that is helpful there. Um, I will most likely mess up the names of the gods. So you can take it for what it's worth. So, for instance, Water to Blood might have attacked Kunum, the guardian of the river's source, Happy, the spirit of the Nile, and Osiris, the Nile was in his bloodstream, according to Egyptian mythology. And these are just three. There were other gods that were attached to the Nile as well. So this is just, again, a sampling or the tip of the iceberg, you might say. And so there is the first god, Khnum, and then there is Happy and Osiris. And so, quite frankly, isn't that a little terrifying to look at, to think about people thinking that was a god? But that was pretty common in Egyptian mythology. All right, the third view is that there was one main god over all the gods, and that the plagues attacked him, thereby attacking all of the gods. And so, again, referencing this book by Friedman, it says this article discusses passages in the Torah's narrative of the ten plagues that can be readily associated with Egyptian worship of the goddess of war, plague and pestilence, Sekhmet, and suggests that God used this deity as the focal point of his defeat of the Egyptian deities. And so this is kind of a deity that incorporated pretty much everything in one way. And so by God defeating this one, then God defeated all the subcategories that would have been associated with the gods of Egypt as well. I thought I had a view of, or a picture of that one. Maybe I did not put that on there. All right, so one of the things I want us to think of is these are at least three of the most common views. There are probably others as well. But one thing I want to say is that none of them really do a disservice to the text. So if we say, well, God was attacking one god per plague, or God was attacking multiple gods per plague, or God used one god to defeat and thereby defeating all the gods of Egypt, none of them do a disservice to the text. And they don't change how we view the scriptures. So I don't want us to think, well, let's get caught up in one or the other and be dogmatic necessarily about that, because it doesn't change the fact that God, however he did it, or however he was doing it, God defeated all of them. You know, that's the primary point that we take away from it. So whatever it may be, God, it does not negate what we find in the text. And so we can read and understand the primary text, and these different possibilities don't negate even a single thing. There is that last one. Again, isn't that a little terrifying? And then you got another one back here that's just terrifying to me, to think that people worshipped this and thought that this was great. All right, think about the plagues. And this is where I'm not going to go through and read every single passage, because y'all don't want to be here, you know, all day. And so here's just the references, and if you want to write them down and go back, I would recommend going back and reading through it, because then you find you can make all these different connections. And so Exodus 7, 14 to 25, you have water to blood. Exodus 8, 1 to 15, you have the plague of frogs. You have the lice or the gnats in Exodus 8, 16 to 19. Flies in Exodus 20 to 32. Exodus 8, 20 to 32. Death of livestock, which is Exodus 9, 1 through 7. And this is one of the points that really is accentuated in Exodus 9, is that God makes a distinction between the livestock of the people of Israel and the livestock of the Egyptians. And so he destroys the livestock of the Egyptians while the livestock of the Israelites is perfectly fine. And he does this with all of them, by the way. It's just particularly accentuated there. Boils, Exodus 9, 8 to 12. Hail, Exodus 9, 13 to 35, which, reading through this a couple of times, this really jumped out at me what God did here. So it destroyed, the hail destroyed the early crops that they were growing. And then, can you imagine being that farmer being like, well, there's my early crops, but at least I've got my late crops. Woohoo, we're good. And God says, nope, the locusts are going to get them. And so whatever the hail didn't destroy, the locusts did. And so God is able to wipe that out as well. It's almost like God had this planned or something. And then, of course, darkness in Exodus 10, 21 to 29, and death of the firstborn in Exodus 11, 1 to 10, where you have the pronouncement that that's what's going to come, and how to not have that fall on your house because the Israelites had to do something there. And then, of course, the fulfillment of that in Exodus 12, 29 and 30. And so, this is just a chart that kind of helps with this. So we have the 10 plagues, and you have all of them lined up on the side, and here's the gods of Egypt. And again, this is just one of the views. But look at how many different gods are connected to this. And if you think about it, I really like this one, because I really think that this helps to accentuate the point. Here's all of the gods that are attached to lightness in the Egyptian, whatever you want to call them, pantheon of gods. And there's so many of them. And yet even the moon god is essentially taken out by this darkness because he can't do anything about it. And of course you have all these different sun gods, and we've got some other quotes we'll read here in just a couple minutes too that attach the Pharaoh to that idea. And none of them can stop even darkness from coming. And so, I mean, there's just this whole list of different gods that are attached to these things. And within each one of them, none of them could stop God from enacting, from working, from pronouncing judgment on them. And so those things are important to keep in mind. Now, don't get too excited. Yes, this is technically the conclusion, but it's rather long, and there's a reason for that. So we have all these different gods that God is dealing with throughout all of the plagues of Egypt that are tied into this. And the final one, I think, is just the nail in the coffin, and that is Pharaoh himself. So you have all these different gods that they're inanimate objects. Yes, they worshiped them, but Pharaoh's a little different, isn't he? Because you have Pharaoh, who is the person standing in front of them, pronouncing himself to be a god, essentially, to the people. And they can see him, and they can to some degree, they can interact with him. Of course, there are laws and rules that guide that. But God kind of saves him for last, because throughout all of this, do you not see Pharaoh's arrogance? He sees himself as a god. His people see him as a god. And so he hardens his heart over and over and over and over again. Go down through the book, the Exodus there, the 10 plagues, and just count how many times Pharaoh hardens his heart. It's actually pretty astounding. Maybe I should add a brief note about that in the sermon itself. But the final god, of course, is that, and I will use the air quotes on that, the final god that God deals out judgment on is Pharaoh himself. So think about this quotation here. The New Kingdom, Egypt, witnessed a major attempt at religious innovation. In the sixth year of his reign, the young Pharaoh, Amenhotep, and he changed his name to Akhenaten, servant of Aten, which, by the way, if you go back here very quickly, let me see if I can find it. Right here, Aten. He is one of the Egyptian sun gods. And so it says here, essentially, that he changed his name to Akhenaten, which is servant of the Aten. And the change heralded an attempt at religious revolution. Akhenaten's aim was to replace the worship of the numerous deities previously venerated in Egypt with the exclusive worship of the sun disk Aten and of himself as the living embodiment of that. Isn't that a little self-serving? Okay, so we're going to get rid of all the gods, and we're just going to worship this one, and oh, that's me. I mean, doesn't that seem very arrogant to us to think about it that way? And so when we follow all of this through, we see Pharaoh's arrogance and his faith in himself, and God essentially leaves him for last. So think about how hearted he was throughout the Exodus, and it's clear that he envisioned himself as this embodiment or as this godlike figure. You know, it doesn't say particularly in the scriptures that Pharaoh saw himself as a god in this particular instance. But we do, of course, know that from secular history, and it just fits into what we know from the scriptures itself. Some pharaohs, it seems, thought themselves to be more powerful than did others. If you read just different Egyptian history, you find that out. But they saw this godlike embodiment in different ways and to varying degrees. Going back to one of the sources, again, it says, throughout ancient Egyptian history, the Egyptian pantheon was a fluid rather than a static one. The attributes of individual gods and goddesses and their perceived relationship to each other shifted over time in accord with these changing fortunes of different regions or temples. And so they go back and forth as to what they want to happen, essentially, or when they want it to happen. And so, can you imagine trying to have faith in through a time like that? This is one of the many problems with the idea of, you know, the different Greek gods and the different Roman gods and the different Egyptian gods. And by the way, that basic idea came over, you find it in early Native American history too, that they had multiple gods based on what they saw and what was happening. And so they had, you know, sun gods and river gods and spirits of this and spirits of that. They're all very similar and they all have the same flaw. There's no objective source to go to. And you get to Pharaoh, and he's not objective. He is subjective to his own whims because he sees himself as a god. Maybe I should make a connection between the embodiment and the Pope. I don't know. Same basic idea, unfortunately. And after all Pharaoh had witnessed, he still opted to pursue the children of Israel to his own destruction. It's interesting, you go through the scriptures and you go through the Old Testament history, how many different foreign leaders God shows his power to. And some of them, they change what they're doing. I mean, you have the king of Nineveh. He changed what he did when he saw the power of God, or when he saw or heard the message of God. You have God who takes Nebuchadnezzar out of power. I think it's 3 years that he makes him wander like a beast, and then takes him and puts him back in power. That doesn't happen. And that's amazing. And so even if he didn't fully accept God, I doubt he defied God in the same way after that. And part of that, by the way, was due to his pride. And of course, we see it over and over and over again with the Israelite kings as well. And so here is Pharaoh. He's seen all of these things, and yet his neck is hardened. He hardens himself. He hardens his heart. He's not going to listen. And it ends up in his own destruction. And so God attacked Pharaoh in two ways. You know, death of the firstborn, and in the death of Pharaoh himself. And that is Exodus 14. I thought I had that on the PowerPoint. Exodus 14, we'll turn over and read that. Exodus 14, beginning in verse 26. And we'll read down through verse 28. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled into it, and the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the hosts of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. And think about what happens here for just a minute. That you have Pharaoh, who has faith in himself, he thinks he's a god. You have the Egyptians who think that Pharaoh is a god. And so they're willing to follow him. They have faith in their army, which was pretty well known as being a powerful army, you know, off and on throughout Egyptian history. And God says, hey, I can take care of all of that at one time. And so he destroys the Egyptians who are with him. He destroys Pharaoh and he destroys the army. These chariots and these weapons that they think make them all powerful, and they can't stop it. They can't stand up in front of it. And so God deals with them in this manner. And so not only was judgment dealt upon the gods in this instance in Egypt, but the children of Israel were witnesses to these acts. It's written there in Exodus 14 and verse 31, "Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his master, or in his servant Moses." I guess you could say they have short-term memory, because by the time we get to Moses on Sinai, they, you know, oh look, we cast this into the fire and out came this golden calf. It's just amazing. And that's what brought you out of Egypt. And how do they get to that point? I don't know. You know, how do they go from seeing all these things that God has given to them and done for them and all the power God has exerted in this instance, and then immediately turn to an idol again that can't do anything? But it's one of those things that I imagine is hard to break. Because if you go back into Egyptian history, just go and look up pictures of the tombs and of the temples, and you see the idolatry absolutely everywhere. There's statues, there's the hieroglyphics on the wall. I mean, it's literally in their writing, the way they wrote. It's everywhere. Of course, the tombs are nothing but that. I started looking at enjoyment, watching some documentaries on Tutankhamun and all the things that they found in him, because it's one of the more complete tombs. And so they had all these artifacts that were tied to this afterlife, and just how wrong everything was as far as their thinking was on that. And yet here we have God who takes care of all of that if we're willing to open our eyes and to see it. And so we have that proverb that we read at the beginning fulfilled. He who is often rebuked and hardens his neck will suddenly be destroyed, and that without mercy. And so we have Pharaoh at the very beginning, who should have listened right off the bat. God says this, do it. And yet he doesn't do it. And God says, okay, here's proof of who I am, and here's proof of my power. And he doesn't listen. And so throughout all of these plagues, these are all rebukes. These are all judgment on Egypt, on the gods of Egypt, and on Pharaoh himself. And yet what we have is that he is unwilling to listen. And so he's destroyed. And there's no coming back from the bottom of the Red Sea for him. You know, there's no spiritual salvation for him here, because he hardened his neck. And so there's no remedy for that. Sorry, reading through the Proverbs this year and doing some different writings on them, I came across that one. I'm like, that fits so perfectly. Surely Solomon had Pharaoh in mind whenever he wrote that one. Maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems to fit so well. And of course, we have Exodus 6 and verse 7 fulfilled as well. I will take you as my people. I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And so this is God bringing them out. And then let's close with Exodus 20 and verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. And isn't that exactly what God was trying to teach the Israelites throughout all of this, as well as dealing judgment on Egypt? That is the big thing there. This is the lesson that they should have learned, to say, you shall have no other gods before me. What one could stand before God here? You know, what one could stand up to God here? It seems that God went through and he did whatever he wanted to do or whatever he thought was best, and that was it. They could not stop it. Well, I hope these things are beneficial to you this morning.